Hey, this is Ed, and before we start the show this week, just a couple of notes. Check out our YouTube page at youtube.com/NQATpod. And if you really want to show your appreciation, you can back us at patreon.com/NQAT. We do an extra show each week, and there's more coming soon. Thanks a lot. I'm here with Wayne. It's the midweek show. How are you, Wayne?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm mentally and physically in great spirits.
All good?
Just about forgot the depressing, crushing feelings of Sunday. And you know what? I think once you get to the point of you accept these defeats, not saying that they're any easier to handle at the time, but they're a little bit easier to get over. Do you know what I mean?
Well, we've gone through that. You got to stage five, haven't you? Acceptance.
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, been wallowing in there for quite a while. But yeah, I mean, maybe there's something in that.
By the way, what shirt are you wearing? Is that Huddersfield Town, Sheffield Wednesday?
It's Manchester United's 95-96 shirt that has. It's a rare prodding time where I'm wearing a football shirt on the podcast. It's got all the names of the players who came before. So I'll just read some out to you. I'm sure you're aware of the shirt, Ed, but for younger viewers and listeners who might not be, Bill Foulkes, Keane, Cunningham, Styles, Hughes, Buchan, Hunter, Gaskill, Alwiston, Goodwin, May.
Wow.
I'm just reading a few names there, and obviously there's some bigger names like Maldonagy and Sammy McElroy.
Luton Town's famous Maldonagy, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is what I was going to say, is that the shirt is adorned with like names of illustrious people like Best and Charlton, but obviously in 95-96, fairly low bar to, clearly, evidently, it's a fairly low bar to get your name emblazoned on the shirt, which I can tell you one interesting fact about the shirt, other than me wearing it. It's the only shirt in Premier League history for Manchester United that was worn in three different seasons.
Yeah. Well, that used to be the way, that you'd have a shirt for more than 1 year, and now it's three shirts a year plus 75 training tops and retro gear and all of that.
Yeah.
I'm not meaning to sound like an old boomer complaining about shirts. Remember in the mid-90s when it used to be the headline every July when United would come out with a new shirt? Horror of parents having to pay for kids to get a shirt. And you'd get some little kid out there with his full kit on and parents go, oh, it's terrible, I have to buy this every year. And now every team on the planet comes out with three new kits a year. We were pioneers, Wayne. Pioneers in screwing parents out of money.
So maybe we were, but you know, I seem to remember the time that everyone did exactly the same, but United got the grief for it. I mean, the thing that United got the grief for, that they probably deserved, is the binning of the grey kit. Not for binning it, but the fact that it had only been out for a few months, and then they brought in a replacement. Now, all they needed to do was, I mean, keep the red and keep this blue and white one, because they're different enough that they wouldn't.
Yeah.
We weren't going to play Barcelona. And even when we played Crystal Palace, we wore the blue and white. So in the FA Cup semi-final. So you were not going to get a clash. But United brought out a white kit to replace the grey kit. And I remember they charged, I think it was $39.99 for the regular shirts at the time, which was still seems quite expensive. Not now, obviously, when you can get the everyday. I'm doing everything to avoid talking about anything to do with Man City, to be honest.
That's all right. Got nothing else to talk about.
I was going to say, like, you know, I know that I get a bit of stick for rambling. But this is one heck of a ramble start, but I'm talking about something specific. Anyway, so there was no point to bringing the white shirt out, but they did bring the white shirt out. And I don't know if you remember the white shirt. It was just a plain white shirt with a crest in the middle. And the thing was, they just said, oh, we'll just charge. To repay the fans, we'll only charge £30 for it. this shirt will only be used for a season, so we'll only charge £30 for it. That doesn't seem like you're helping the fans out a little bit. But, and I was on that 15,
well, that great kit is probably worth it. It's a collector's item now. I mean, it was one of the first shirts to have stealth technology that bent light around it and the players couldn't see each other and all of that. So it was
Did you ever have one?
I did not have one of those. I had a few in the mid-90s, but I did not have that grey one.
So you've not felt the material on it?
No.
It's quite disgusting. I mean, the polyester efforts that some teams are putting out in, but it is dreadful.
Because I've got a few of those from the mid-90s, and there's something about the fabric. It feels like if you're too close to a heat source, it'll definitely melt.
So yeah.
There's something nasty about it. Kits are very different these days.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Exciting. Talking of kits, did you notice that Barcelona, this is their latest ruse to solve their financial problems? They are ditching Nike, or Adidas, or one of them, whoever's their shirt manufacturer, and going out alone, which I thought to myself, that's going to be an interesting challenge in distribution. I know United kind of mulled this over the years, or at least there was reporting on it, and generally stepped away because of one, guaranteed income, and most clubs don't like taking risks on building new markets, so the guaranteed income is better than building your own market. And then distribution, you've got to build a network where you not only manufacture it, but get it out to thousands of sports outlets and websites and stuff around the world, unless you go fully D2C, and then you've got to spend a lot of money on advertising
in order
to replace those channels. So every other club's always rejected that route. Barcelona, we'll see. Although they've done this with a few other parts of their business. If you notice how they set up companies and then sold part of the companies to dodgy private equity companies. And I'm like, this all looks like a scam. I don't believe that it's real. So we'll see whether they do that with this one too.
Like the Barcelona and Juventus transfer activity over the four or five players that they did. You're like, oh, that looks completely normal.
This third team player is going to cost 900 million euros. Yeah.
And
that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Forgive me for being utterly football fan about this, but they're like homemade kits always look naff, don't they? Whenever you've seen them, they do look rubbish. And I'm not saying that United have had some stinkers in recent years, but at least they look professional. Whereas, like, you know, when a fan, I remember, there's been a few English clubs who've done it, and it's always the ones who fall into financial difficulty thinking that this is a way out or a way of generating a larger lump sum of money without, like you said, the key factor is distribution. And they always look naff. They always look rubbish. You wouldn't want to wear one of those things because they were like, there's someone in Adidas or Nike who's like, their job is to graphic design, kit design. They know what they're doing. They're experts in the field for a reason. I'm not saying they always look nice, but they have all these templates and everything for a reason. But when they left to someone in the club or someone who the club hires to do it, and they say, all right, this is what you've got to work with, it never ends well.
I did briefly explore doing a NQAT kit, but it's really expensive, actually. If you don't do large volumes, which we won't, I mean, you know, as much as there are many listeners out there, it's impossible to get the price down to a reasonable point. So charging people 40 quid for a piece of naff-looking polyester seems kind of pointless, honestly. So I didn't put that together. Let me know if there's massive demand. If anyone out there wants to order 10,000 of them, we'll go do it.
Oh, they'll look good. I'm not criticizing the podcast shirts, but they're there for a purpose, right? They're there to do what they say that they're doing. We're not expected to be Adidas or Nike or Umbro in this delicious shirt that I'm wearing at the moment. Yeah.
Umbro, the glory days. All right. How have you actually coped with the fallout from City then? It's been kind of interesting because I think there's been sort of hysterical media fallout in the past from United defeats to City, but this time out it was the pundits had got themselves in such a tizzy prior to the game, predicting massive cricket scores and all of that kind of stuff, that the United making it competitive for an hour and losing 3-1 in the end was kind of, oh, okay, well, that wasn't apocalyptic, so we can't really go with the apocalyptic headlines. Is that how you felt in the days afterwards?
Yeah, it's a strange one. It really is a strange one because on one hand, like you said, there are elements to it where you look at the players that we played and you say, well, you can't really expect much more than that. But then there is the other side of it's never easy to lose a game like that. And when you look at the possession stats and you look at the shot stats, even if you can understand all the extenuating circumstances, it's still hurtful to look at it. And it's not great to hear a manager talk about fine margins. It's, you know, like if for a foul there or if for a foul
there. It wasn't there, a good look, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and this is from someone who's given the manager much of the benefit of the doubt and cut him so much slack that you just want to see a little bit of. We could all see it on Sunday. And you can see it even with a full team that United. I'm not saying that they would have, maybe they would have put up a better fight, but it's still, you would have expected not massively dissimilar numbers, maybe a few more efforts on goal. United could have had a few more efforts on goal. They were working good spaces in the first half when it was 1-0 on the counter. They were working some good spaces.
Yeah, a few moments.
But they never got the shots away. I'm not defending the performance, by the way. I'm just saying that the numbers could have looked a little bit different on that side of it. They didn't. And they tell their own story for that reason. So I look at it and I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is, in as it was happening, and I'm seeing a team finish with Forson and Kambwala on the pitch, and Johnny Evans being our best defender, who's running himself into the ground after 65 minutes, and he comes off and it all falls apart. When I see a team like that in the immediate aftermath, when I'm watching this, I'm thinking, I can understand it, right? And I can get over it quickly. But then the like two or three days that come with that, and then you think you've got to bridge that gap to be better than them, regardless of what we say about 115 and all that sort of stuff. We've got to go from where we are now, regardless of all the excuses, of all the valid reasons. We've still, if we want to be better than them, have got to bridge that gap to be better than them and do better than that. And it feels as far away as it could be, really.
It does feel that. I mean, it's not, of course, because there's a pathway to producing good side again. And it's multifaceted. And I don't think anyone at Ineos who are putting together all the kind of organizational structure now are thinking that they're going to fix this in one window. I'm sure.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, fans may want that with football manager style transfer windows and stuff like that. But it's unlikely, very unlikely to happen. But the pathway is, look at Liverpool's resurgence after refreshing their squad, albeit under Klopp, who's a special kind of personality, or maybe, sorry to say this, Arsenal's development under Arteta, who've gone from being nothing, eighth and eighth, to they probably won't win the league this season, but challenges, competitive. Yeah. In fact, having like a superb defensive record that's keeping them competitive even without a striker, basically. So there's the pathway. You make better, smarter decisions and United will improve. But you're right. Yeah, in the sort of 3 days after that kind of defeat, the gap's as wide as it's ever been. And it was 3-1 because United made it competitive for an hour, but they made it competitive for an hour by closing the game down in a way that feels unbefitting of Manchester United, but pragmatically, really the only choice.
Yeah. So. The other thing that makes me feel a little bit better is that watching Arsenal against Sheffield United, because the league is so ridiculously weak at the moment in a sort of top-heavy kind of way. I know we've talked about it before, but the point, the prevailing point is that United don't play, they wouldn't play City for 38 games. They play them for 2 out of 38 and they play another 36 against all the other sides.
Mm-hmm.
And the gap between us and Arsenal might look light years away, like it the way that Arsenal played the other night, but I look at it the other way and I say, well, Sheffield United were dreadful, Burnley are dreadful, that we are getting a generation of really abysmal sides who can't compete. Luton, by and large, are a dreadful Premier League side. And I don't, you know, they've given us 2 good games, really, but they are, you know, that's not barometer of standard at the moment. They are a pretty dreadful Premier League side, historically speaking. And we are at that cusp of that. There are a good few teams in there, like Villa have got something a little bit different under Ange. Spurs look like a different kind of proposition, but they're still, Spurs are still in the area where you would expect Spurs to be, and Chelsea are having their part. Villa are in the area where you would expect them to be. West Ham will fluctuate. United don't have a massive bridge to cross in terms of getting to to Arsenal and Liverpool. I don't believe so anyway. I think that those kind of steps are, we can definitely be competitive with them with a fully fit squad.
Yeah.
And we could be able to surpass them with a couple of really good transfer windows. I think that's manageable. And then you've got the secondary argument of, can you accumulate more points than City in those 36 games, which again is a different conversation. It's just getting that oil tanker turned to be like that. And you look at us where we are and you think, all right, players back, good argument. Ten Hag, 50-50 at this moment in time, because the longer it goes on, you're asking those questions, aren't you? And I think that's it. How many big changes are we going to need to make to get the everything in order to be able to make those progressions? Because a manager's two steps back, isn't it, really? Because you new players, new system and all that sort of stuff. So, and I think that's where I am in this midweek. Like, we're speaking 3 days after it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, coming to terms with where we are, because those are the big games. The big games are the ones where you sort of, we might feel a little bit better after we play Liverpool in the cup. We might feel worse. Might feel better after playing Arsenal at the end of the season. Might feel worse.
Yeah. I know. There's big picture, and then there's the aftermath of one defeat, and they are two slightly different things. Although clearly you can extrapolate one from the other.
Yeah.
And we. We naturally will all tend to do that. I would say, I think, of course, the focus is going to be on Ten Hag over the next 11 games. He's under a lot of pressure and the cup. But I very, very much doubt, reading between the lines of what's been put out there and Ratcliffe's interviews and the way they've gone about doing their business on the operational side of the club, that they are thinking like that. I don't think there's necessarily anything Ten Hag can do in the next 12 with the cup, or maybe more games, to save his job or otherwise. I suspect that they're already thinking about what the next options are. Yeah. And as I said, top down, CEO, director of football, technical director, recruitment head, that's the structure. And Ratcliffe has said it over and over again. That's the structure they're going to build under which a head coach will work. And it'll be a head coach of the style they're looking for. And Ten Hag's options really are to either United win all their upcoming games, which would make it 15 games, I think, and somehow sneak into the Champions League places, and everyone feels really good about themselves, and he sort of forces their hand, as well as showing that there's some kind of pathway to the kind of football that the new management team want, right? Or he doesn't do that, and it just plays out United performing okay over the next few games, and likelihood is, I think it's more than 50-50, you'll get replaced. And it's really nothing to do with him. It's much more to do with the project, to use that word, that they are trying to build here. And then the third question really is there someone that's appropriate to replace him? But I definitely think that United are going to try and get out of this kind of messianic view of the coach, and just changing that coach out every time it doesn't work for a few times, because there have been plenty of experienced coaches that have completely failed in this environment over the last 10 years. And Ratcliffe has got to be right when he says, hey, maybe it isn't the coaches, maybe it's the club.
Yeah.
And so we'll get to there. And part of that, of course, is getting all those people into place, which hasn't happened yet, apart from Berarda, who we'll see in June because City played ball. We haven't had any new details on Ashworth. I guess there's negotiations going on behind the scenes about exactly how much that is going to cost. It's kind of ridiculous, isn't it, that we have to have that negotiation about a suit, which is modern football, man. And it seems like there's maybe some effort, conflicting reports this week in The Guardian and The Telegraph about Dougie Friedman as potentially recruitment head working under Rashford and or Jason Wilcox from Southampton. No more further movement on that one. And then a report in ESPN, I think, this week talking about Darren Fletcher's role. He's the technical director, but really he's a kind of first team coach. I think he doesn't really have the traditional technical director remit. So moving pieces, but nothing solid yet on the operational side.
Yeah. Dougie Friedman. Jason Wilcox. I just thought it was like a list of sort of mid-table 90s footballers.
90s players, yeah.
Rule Fox will be there. Jeremy Goss.
Rule Fox would be a bit older, wouldn't he, than Dougie Friedman and Jason Wilcox?
Yeah, yeah. Friedman's probably turn of the century, maybe a little bit after that, to be fair. Jason Wilcox, obviously, was in the Blackburn team that won the league.
Yeah.
Stuart Ripley on the other side. See, I remember Blackburn's title-winning team a little bit too well. Yeah, I always go back to the conversation we've had so many times, and I don't want to feel like we're hitting the repeat button on all these conversations, but we're at this such a critical time with Ten Hag that every manager sort of gets to, and then we bolt. He's overseeing the transition. It's almost completely his squad. You know, another transfer window of being properly backed to move on and keep playing. Because, I mean, it'll be if Maguire, McTominay and Martial, just to name the three most prominent players who get talked about this kind of thing, if they're here in August to kick off a new season and we don't have better options to replace them, then you would start to significantly doubt the decision-making of the manager compiling the squad. But you've got to let a manager get to that point. Any manager,
yeah.
Like I've said before, every single manager, like Mourinho, Van Gaal, Ole, they've always sort of fell that one transfer window short. And maybe, you know what, that's the perennial excuse of any manager, right? You know, if they're failing, you always say, well, one more transfer window, they could have got it right. But United always feel like they're on the cusp of that. It always feels like that whenever they've changed a manager.
It does, yeah. Though I would say this one is different, because what has happened is things have changed around above him. So
of course,
we could say, yeah, we're bolting a bit too early. We're not giving the manager enough time if he goes. That is, he needs another window of backing. We've given him low knees in the winter transfer windows, or not even this that much this winter transfer window just gone. We're always one window short. We don't quite back the manager, and all of that is true. And on the opposite side of that coin, you can go, well, the results aren't good enough.
Yeah,
and ultimately it's a results game and all of that. But I just think there's the other factor now, the organizational change, and that's going to come first. Yeah. If the new team fulfill their promise, which is organizational structure first, manager second, then that will dictate what happens with Ten Hag more than what happens on the pitch. Although obviously he can go a very long way towards getting himself sacked by not getting good results over the next 11 games.
Yeah.
If United run at the same points per game total they have done for this season and lose half their games coming, the club will finish sixth or seventh and he'll definitely get the boot.
Yeah.
Whatever happens. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I did want to talk about Ole, because he was obviously on the overlap this week and has given some media interviews. And I can't help having this kind of feeling of deep nostalgia whenever he speaks. Can't help it. He's just such a nice man.
Yeah.
And obviously everything he did for the club on the pitch factors into that, but also his time as manager. And he talked more openly than he has done, I think, about his time as manager. And there were a few points in there. So, I mean, what do you think of that, the interview for a start, and some of the stuff he said?
I'm going to start by saying for 20 years, he's been in English football. And you know this man has got the patience of a saint by the fact that he's allowed everybody to mispronounce his first name for that entire time.
Ole.
Solskjaer. On the tapes that I've got, the Tom Tyrrell tapes, I've got his first ever interview where he pronounces his name, he says his name, and he says it exactly like that. And I thought, yep, I'm guilty too. Incredible patience of a man who can sort of tolerate that. If I just called you Ad for the entirety of the podcast, or you called me Dwayne, as people might do, it would get infuriating after a while.
It would do. He's just been anglicized. My old manager at my work before I moved stateside, it was Norwegian. Indian-American, but had lived in Norway for 25 years and obviously pronounced it correctly. And I couldn't help but do a double take every time, because you're so ingrained in calling him Ollie.
And it's
obviously not Ollie. So Ulla did a very good interview this week.
Yeah. What's in the name?
Yeah,
the nostalgia with Ollie is so great. because, I mean, I wondered about the impacts that, first of all, the job would have on him and his enthusiasm and his character. And what would you say? Not love for the club, because I guess that's always deep-rooted, but the way that cynicism, if you get involved in a different kind of role, and then you might have a bit, you might become a little bit colder to the club. Like Wilf McGuinness, and I think he could draw many comparisons with the two in terms of the managerial career, but, you know, his hair fell out while he was United manager. The stress got to him that much. And,
well, it's the stress of writing books that made your hair fell out.
Yeah.
When I first met you, you had hair.
Stress of building up to this podcast is what it was.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So not this particular one, but there's just these podcasts in general, of course.
Do you go to the same hairdresser as Ten Hag? He was disgracefully getting a haircut this week.
Yeah. Do you know what?
Disgracefully.
That is funny because on Monday night, I went to the barber's as well. And the first thing the barber said, because I went for just a beard shape, just because I was too lazy to do it myself. And the barber looked at me and he said, "Why are you here?" Well, yeah, it's a good question. And that's what I thought when, I wonder if that's what they asked Ten Hag when he was there, like, what have you done? What have you come for? But he went for the same thing as me. So apparently he's as lazy as I am when it comes to personal grooming. But back on to Solskjaer, who thankfully can still go to the barbers for proper reasons.
Yeah.
I am delighted to hear when he talks about the club with the enthusiasm that he always has. I feel nothing of my opinion of him before he went into the job has changed as a consequence of what he did in the job. I still love him just as much. In fact, probably more than that. Yes, I wanted him to succeed more because of who he was, but I also pragmatic and realistic enough to know it was running away from him. Like you said earlier, there's the other side of the coin, the results turn against the managers, and that was certainly the case with Ollie. Although, as disappointing as it was, and, you know, it was heartbreaking at the time. And, you know, you see the interview, the exit interview he did where he was in tears.
Yeah.
And that was one of the, and any proper Manchester United fan, that's got to be one of the most difficult things to watch. I'm talking top 10 most difficult things to watch in our history. That video is up there. It's very, very difficult. If you love the club and you understand what the love that he has for the club as well. I must admit, I've not seen all of the interviews. I've seen a few clips. I've seen the clip where Keno's talking about driving 8 hours to see him. Amazing to imagine Roy Keane's just decided one time he's going to go over and he's going to drive to see you. You know that he's on that drive and it's an 8 hour unavoidable drive. He's going all the way. Then you're going to be stuck with him in the middle of nowhere. And it's going to be a while until he goes because it's 8 hours to get back.
Yeah, you've got to have a good chunk of time there. Yeah, but he knows that he'd have stuck his self-help podcast on and the high-performance podcast and whatever.
Yeah, listen to some Jake Humphrey.
Oh, God almighty. Yeah, it'd be enough to make you drive into the oncoming traffic, wouldn't it? Bloody hell. Yes, I did like that. I mean, there were some headlines, of course, that came out, as Ollie said, in doing it. Yeah, obviously talked about Ronaldo. It was interesting. He kept insisting it was the right decision. It was the right decision, but it didn't work out for the club or Ronaldo. And I'm like, doesn't it mean it was the wrong decision? But I think what he means is that at the time, they believed they were doing the right thing.
Like, yeah,
they believed it would work out for all parties, and in retrospect, it didn't. And I think he's kind of been generous there because I think, not that Ronaldo deliberately fucked him, but I think it was so destabilizing for the team and Ollie's squad that it contributed significantly to the downward spiral of performances under Ollie. But he didn't say it like that.
No, I think, as well, being a United legend, and we're talking upper echelon of United legends, that there is always like political leaning to where he's going to say something. And so you have to understand that from the perspective that he's not going to throw a legend under the bus, which Ronaldo undoubtedly is, regardless of the way that it ended. Now, the context of what he said, he certainly, like you said, it didn't work out. But the context of how he was signed, and if that was a mistake, you then have to balance it against the idea that Manchester City could have signed him, the embarrassment that would have caused a lot of people at United, whether or not it was worth bringing him back. We all know it was catastrophic at the end, but there are certain elements which we've talked about, which I've talked about on this podcast, like, was it worth him coming back for the moments of history that he registered while he was in the shirt? On a numbers basis, on a performance basis, absolutely not, because it wouldn't matter where he was when he became the leading scorer in the history of men's football. Were United on the periphery of becoming a championship winning side? Did it really matter that much? Don't know. There's two and throws on either side of that. But then the other side, which I always, and I said this at the time, and it was just my gut feeling, the well was dry as far as signings were concerned when they found the money for Ronaldo. And the Ronaldo thing was a speculative buy in order to bring money in. And it worked for that purpose. It was a massive marketing signing. And I guess they made a certain amount of money back on him. But the money that we needed to spend at the time was for a defensive midfielder. That's what we needed. Mm-hmm. That team desperately needed a defensive midfielder. We weren't, all right, we could have done still better. Exactly. And we still needed another striker, a proper mobile, young, pacey striker, because Martial wasn't convincing then either. And we needed a right-sided player. We'd signed Sancho, but he was playing on the left. So we had all those kind of issues that we had anyway. The money... But the money really, really, really needed to be spent on a defensive midfielder, and it wasn't. And then, obviously, what you're doing then is you're questioning the decisions from above. And I know I'm diverging that, going away from the point somewhat, but to return to the Ronaldo thing, because it was a shot out of the blue, and they had to do it. I wonder if that's the way, the context in which he means it, in that if he was manager of the club when Ronaldo went to Man City, regardless of whether or not people said that Guardiola was calling his bluff, I'm pretty sure that Ronaldo looked like he was set to leave Juventus and City needed a player. They would have, even if Guardiola never played him, if he only played him in the League Cup games and then that kicked off and everything, like he previously did with, he had massive arguments with Zlatan, didn't he? That kind of profile of signing.
Yeah.
They could have done that just to rub United's noses in it, and they would have loved it. The officials of City, they would have loved doing that, because at that point, City understood that they weren't getting Messi, so it wouldn't have mattered if they brought in Ronaldo. So there was all those kind of political arguments to it. And so I'm not saying that I'm convinced that it was the right decision. I don't mean that, but I can understand his reasons for saying it in two different ways.
Fair enough. Ronaldo this week got a two-match ban from the Saudi League for what I think was a kind of wanker gesture towards the crowd who were chanting "Messi, Messi, Messi." It was a little bit odd because he was sort of halfway between a wanker gesture and an air guitar, and I was kind of like, was he trying to suggest that he has a really long dick, or was he just over exaggerating the wanker gesture? Because normally, if you're English, you do it up here, right, so people can see you're doing. For YouTubers, YouTube viewers, you can see what I'm doing here. Podcasts, I'm doing the old wanker gesture, but he did it down there, which was a little odd, and not with a closed fist either. I'm technically analyzing Ronaldo's, I think, offensive gesture. It was very strange. Anyway, also really weird. The man's worth hundreds of millions of pounds, euros, dollars, whatever currency, and as top scorer in history, he's won everything. To get so rattled just by someone chanting the name of someone you haven't played against for 5 years and now playing completely different leagues, it's really weird. That ego is very, very thin, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it can be at that level. And then he's definitely a player who he's funny because he seems so cast iron. I will say, when you're telling me this, it's news to me because I don't follow the Saudi League as closely as you had. Even Ronaldo.
I saw the social clips. Talking of crappy kits, as we were earlier, still looks like the kit that his team played looks like Dog and Duck or something like that, made by one of those manufacturers you never heard of before. Yeah,
really, really bad. It's terrible.
One of the other things that Ole said, was that he felt that some of the players didn't want to play in that final game against Watford, or they didn't want to come out for the second half.
Yeah.
He kind of suggested that. And it was interesting because, of course, everyone's looking at who the substitutions were at halftime. And you're like, uh-oh, because one of them was Marcus Rashford going off for Anthony Martial. And in the week that so many people have been questioning Marcus's commitment to the club and he pushed back, it was kind of added a little spin to the narrative there. I don't know whether to make anything of that or not, or adding two and two together and making a lot more than five.
Yeah.
But
I think that straightforward math is usually, with this Manchester United side, feels like, side, squad, era, feels like it's usually on the money. I don't think you stray too far. But, you know, if this speculation, there's usually smoke with fire at United at the moment. So it's not well closeted, but you don't have to go digging very far because the people put it out that clearly through the different people. Do I think that he was talking about Rashford specifically? I don't know. I can't answer because it is a difficult one. He doesn't seem like he is the context again. He is the conflict as well. Is that he? Ollie isn't a person who calls people out, but he was calling. You know what I mean? You can't say something like that and not know that people are going to come to their own conclusions with that. So if you know that they're going to come to their own conclusions with that, you know that there's an obvious place to start, like you said. And then it seems fairly evident who he's talking about, and especially when you're talking about a player who has received criticism for just those kind of things. It is kind of concerning. Yeah, I mean, the Watford game, to be fair.
I can't believe anyone wanted to stay on the pitch over that abysmal.
Yeah.
In that one. I didn't want to say watching it.
So. Well, this reminds me of the story that Gordon Hill tells about the FA Cup final in 76. He came off and he was gutted. He was devastated. United were losing 1-0 against Southampton second division. So Gordon comes off and he says to Tommy Dock, he goes, "Why me, boss?" Remember that in the old days, they just put up the number 11. And he says, "Well, I meant the full team." He meant the full 11 come off. They were that bad. But yeah, they couldn't do that. Although they can make a number of more substitutes these days. He couldn't do that.
We should retrospectively VAR that one, though, because that was a mile offside, that goal. Disgraceful. Absolutely disgraceful.
If he wasn't... People say that. He's entered the mythical canon of mile offside. Go back and watch it. It's not... It's quite... You would need to VAR it because it is quite close. I do think he is off, but yeah. Anyway... It looked like a few players didn't want to be on that pitch. It's like the other day against Fulham when we played them all at Trafford. The second half was such a test of endurance for everyone, and it just felt like nobody wanted to be there. And that's what I just feel like sometimes with this United team. When they're off song, when they are off colour, it does feel like nobody wants to be there. And I'm not talking about Marcus. I'm talking about everyone from on the pitch to the supporters watching them at Old Trafford, because away, obviously, the supporters are great. But at Old Trafford, it can really feel like it's everyone's being put through something.
The only one who still wants to be there is Kath, the tea lady, because she will be ever present and permanent.
Yeah.
Not tea lady, right?
Receptionist.
Very old-fashioned. Yeah. Receptionist, yeah. Yes, it's well worth going to watch all of that. And as much as Gary Neville grates sometimes, I do think that kind of format where they're just all around, there's Wrighty and Keane and Gary Neville and Chamberlain. Who else do they have in that group?
Carragher.
Oh, yeah, that's unfortunate. I want to get rid of him.
Let me just make a comment on this, because those people, those pundits, and I'm talking Carragher and Neville in particular, Keane was always more sympathetic with Ulla. Always more sympathetic with him. But Neville, and particularly Carragher, was scathing on Solskjaer throughout his reign towards the latter end. They were scathing on him. To do the old pals lights with him.
Well, I'm sure he knows they've got a job to do. And like I do think with some of these, like we often talk about it as fans in a kind of this neutral fashion, but they are entertainment. Right, so they get pushed into becoming entertainment. Now, Keane has become a parody of himself sometimes. That's his job thing, for sure. So I think there's part of that. Anyway, yes, I tend not to listen to the Gary Neville commentary because I find him a bit grating. And they have a bunch of very neutral people on US TV that I can just watch the game and zone them out, which is much nicer. A few other things happened this week. Paul Pogba got a 4-year ban. I know he's not a United player, but he was. He's been a big part of recent history.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but feel kind of sad about this. And I don't know how much of his responsibility. There's a piece in The Guardian, I think, talking about the kind of still over-medicalized nature of Juventus. And it ties into, I think, what Neville was talking a few weeks back when he was talking about how unbelievably fit and strong they thought they were doped up to the eyeballs in the early 2000s. So it's sad anyway, isn't it, that this career that could have been something, should have been something completely different, has turned out to have petered out and then been ended in a doping scandal.
The Juventus thing made me laugh because we struggled against Juventus in the 90s, but we generally wipe the floor with them after the turn of the century. So, use the excuse before, not after. Yeah, it's a funny one with Pogba. I mean, as ever a player, I doubt it'll ever happen again, where a player can be transferred for nearly £90 million and be described as a colossal waste of money, and then move somewhere on a free transfer and still be a colossal waste of money. And time as well for Juventus to bring him back. And see, he got injured straight away. He barely played for him when he was there. And then this has happened as well. He's a player who's obviously throughout his career, when Mino Raiola was alive, he was badly advised at certain points. Obviously, very, very wealthy. Yeah, you can feel sad for him because apparently, I mean, everyone at United liked him. So he wasn't unlikable. He's just badly advised and never sort of seemed fully committed. And seems always engaged with that. I mean, there was never a season went by where he wasn't the headline. He was an headline exit every single summer, and it was great. And that very quickly came the case where even as early as 2 years into his reign at United, his return, you just wanted it to end, even if it meant him going. And the talent, and he was so talented. And I'm speaking about him now with the assumption that his career's over. He was so talented, but you only ever saw that once in every 3 or 4 games, because the rest of the time you saw someone plodding along, very, very careless in possession for a player who had so much strength. He looked like you couldn't bully him off the ball, but he'd just give it away. He could do mercurial things, the way that he could strike a ball from 30-odd yards and look like he's a daisy. You know what I mean? He had such strength in the way that he did things. His vision was incredible. I can remember some passes that he played. You just think, how on earth did he do that? And there was a famous game against Leeds where he set up the 4 goals.
Yeah.
He was on his day. He is probably the ultimate on-his-day player, really, because you look at him and you think he had all the attributes, like Ravel Morrison, all of the attributes that you'd be talking about him in the conversation with Ballon d'Or winners.
Yeah, absolutely.
Add all that.
Yeah. And like Paul and I used to go around in circles, you know, loved the myth of the player, perhaps more than the actual execution of the player.
Yeah.
Quite often. And yeah, a lot of complexity around him, both in terms of what he delivered, not good enough often enough, but even in those days that he was terrible, he would pull out a magnificent piece of skill or ball or goal or whatever it was. And the frustration was always like, why isn't he able to put it together all at the same time more often, in the way that more often happened with France? And France at a time that they were a very good side, but a very conservative side. And you're like, well, it shouldn't fit him.
Exactly.
As well.
Yeah.
But it did somehow. And yes, then the off the field stuff that wound a lot of people up. Every time he went away on an international break, there was an interview with French press that got translated back to England, and it was some form of come and get me, plea to Real Madrid or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the badly advised comes into play. And yeah, the whole package was frustrating and expensive and ultimately a waste. I still get messages now, by the way, very frequently, which go along the lines of something like this: Ed, you loved Paul Pogba and you called us all racist for not liking him. And I'd just like to say I did not do that. I did say I did not like the language around him.
Yeah.
of which Graeme Souness was one of the biggest villains, but also, yeah, internet channels and stuff. Like, falling into the tropes around young black players, I think, is a very easy thing to do. Happens way too often. Yeah. It's happening with Marcus now. Let's separate out the reality from this kind of myth creation that we do as a society, which I don't think is very healthy. And that's all my point was generally. We do have a game at the weekend.
Yeah.
Against the mighty Everton, who by then may, because at some point we're going to get their second charge. They've gone from 10 points deducted to 6. And the thinking around that was 2 points of mitigation on their PSR infraction.
Yeah.
But not all of them. So they found guilty on 7 points of their 9 claims, most of which was completely spurious if you've read any of it. But
yeah,
they have been found guilty on that first infraction. Almost certainly they'll be found guilty on the second one, so they may well be getting another 6 points coming. So they are in deep, deep relegation trouble in a season of 3 absolutely abysmal sides that really deserve to go down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, they'll be desperate for it. United and Ten Hag desperately need a win as well. It's one of those lunchtime games, which I never like.
Yeah.
Something funny about them, which is a cliche again. But anyway, yeah, what are your thoughts ahead of this one?
Yeah, like United need an excuse to not get started. List one reason, 101, early kickoff. Yeah, Everton, as many points redeemed by refund as earned on the pitch since Christmas, 4 points. Like I said, they'll probably get them taken off. Well, no, it's true. It's true. I looked that up before we came on air because I thought that could be my one witty quip of the podcast, and I got it in. Sean Dyche's Everton do not look like a Sean Dyche team, and that's because football has probably passed Sean Dyche by. The era in which a Sean Dyche team could expect to thrive. Maybe the personnel isn't right. You know, like Everton have got higher expectations than Burnley, but Everton have, unfortunately for them, because they are a massive football club. So their ambitions are to be breaking into the top four as the size of the club you would expect, but they're thriving over the last 25, 30 years even. It's probably been
more.
Well, yeah.
When they last win something.
Yeah, well, I'm not even talking about it. I'm talking about, yeah, but it's 30 years since they last won something, but I'm talking then Joe Royal came in as manager and they were known as the Dogs of War. And then David Moyes came in, and the best that David Moyes' teams were when they were battlers, and the best that they've been since then, like under Martinez, under Sean Dyche for a little period, has been when they are battlers against the wall. Hmm. So that's the personality that they've adopted. So, ironically, he should be the perfect manager for them, but football's passed him by now. Football's passed him by. It's a little bit too late. Everton are in trouble. The only optimism I've got from United, for United getting a win, is because of how poor Everton are at the moment.
They really crap on the pitch, and they've got lots of trouble off it. I mean, not just the points deduction and the next one that's coming, but also they're now. You know, Mashiri wants out because he's wasted £500 million on Everton that he's never going to get back.
Yep.
They are heavily in debt to 777 Partners, his Fulch Capital firm, which itself is heavily in debt. I think the way that was, I don't know whether you read it, there's a piece in Jotamar, the sort of investigative sports magazine. They do fantastic stuff digging into 777 Partners, who are not one of the well-established, known, highly capitalized private equity groups at all. They look like sharks if you dig into them. And that was basically the tenet of the piece. So their strategy appears to be buy up all of Everton's debt, force a cheap sale if the Premier League ratifies it. I wouldn't be surprised whether they wouldn't actually, in some sense, want Everton just get relegated so they could push this through, which might well happen. And then they can build from there. But either way, right, Everton, it's going to be a while until they build again. They are building this fantastic looking new stadium, which they may be playing championship football in, which is not befitting of the history of the club, but maybe befitting of how the club has been run over the last few years and the quality of the team on the pitch, which is even without the points deduction, only just better than relegation fodder.
Everton, unfortunately for those supporters, and I do mean that, this might be one battle too many for them. We've seen them. We've lived through Everton having like three or four near misses with relegation, and everyone's talked about they've been the perennial side that's never got or hasn't gone down for it. I don't profess to know Everton's history. It's at least the longest surviving team without relegation or something like that. But it does feel, it's starting to feel like it's won too many battles, especially with the extra charge coming over them. And like you said, the very high probability, the way that the recent events have gone, that they're going to get another hefty points deduction. Yeah, and for football, so much in football is about psychology and momentum, and Everton are on that slope now. Yeah, all right, they could turn out bizarre freak result at Old Trafford because they're going to put everything on the line for that. That's what teams do, and we've seen them get results in the recent past at Old Trafford. It's not out of the realms of possibility. A lot of that will depend on whether or not we've got some of the players back. I know it looks like it's a bit too early for Martinez, although he was with the squad the other day. It's a bit too early to say whether Oyland's going to be in the team, but he's at least in the conversation that he could be back. And, you know, United, I mean, the game plan against City was they played with two midfielders as strikers, right? And that was done to be pragmatic, to get a result. We can't do that again. And they couldn't afford, not even like they could do it again, but the crowd would turn against Ten Hag if that's the team that turned out on Saturday. So there's also got to be a response, because I think we can accept and we can stomach just about what we saw on Sunday, because we, you know, it's difficult, but we understand where we are. Right thinking, rational thinking supporters understand where we are. But then we are also the team that goes to Sheffield United and scrapes a 2-1 win, and we watch our rivals score 50 goals there.
Loads.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So we need to start seeing better performances from our team, and that's Ten Hag's responsibility as much as it is the players at this moment in time. And it has to start on Saturday. It has to start then.
I fully agree. Yeah, I mean, another scraped victory. Like, at this point, what does it mean?
Yeah.
If we get into the Champions League, it's through the back door anyway, because it'll be this fifth place for this extra place in the now confirmed Swiss format, as we knew, which, by the way, is going to be absolutely horrible. Just absolutely horrible. Why are they doing this? I mean, it's just more football for the sake of more football, but it's not more better football.
No.
Only a third of teams. So only a third of teams will not get through. So 36 teams, top 8 guaranteed. The next 16 have a playoff against each other in order to progress, and the bottom 8 are eliminated. And it's just like, what, why? It just means for so many of those games as a proportion, there's no jeopardy.
Yeah.
But anyway, if we get into that horrible format, Super League by any other name, it will be through the back door in fifth place, because United are not going to make up 11 points or 12 because of the goal difference on Aston Villa in 11 games. Just don't see it. 11 points behind them, and we beat them twice.
Yeah, I thought that'd be the other day. That's
how? That is damning. And it's 6 on Tottenham.
Yeah.
And that's a lot in 11 games as well, given the level of our consistency. So if we make it, it'll be fifth. If we make fifth, it's the back door because of this extra place, which is not guaranteed, because actually Premier League teams' performances in Europe have been quite mixed this season, including United and Newcastle. So we'll see. But it's important for the club. It's important in terms of the budget and what can be spent and our progress and all of that. And so, yada, yada, yada. Beat Everton on Saturday, please. Thank you very much.